Okay, this is Vic Cunicelli. The time is 1:40 p.m. and we're back on record.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor. Again, we appreciate all the time you're giving us and on this beautiful day. I have some questions again on the lessons learned. Just want to kind of go back there for a second. Were you in the lessons learned? Did you see any formal reports that you were, involved with on lessons learned or postmortems that you could provide us?
I believe I've spoken on a couple occasions on lessons learned and would have presented PowerPoint slides discussing some of the lessons we've learned.
So there was, do you think there was there any formal report done either by your group
I'm
or
I'm not
others?
Aware of a formal report, Moody's official report on lessons learned. We do have a formal report on initiatives we've taken to strengthen and enhance our ratings processes and analytical efforts, and embedded in those recommendations is implicit lessons learned or things we've decided would improve our processes. But I don't think it has a component in that report of a formal lessons learned document.
Also, were you aware of any major discussions with concerning market share, maintaining market share over the 2007-2006 period?
Generally, you're talking about were there discussions of concerns about the rate, the amount of ratings we were assigned.
Maintaining market share. It is
market share meaning the number of ratings relative to other agencies assigning. I just want to make sure I have a full understanding of how you're using the term. The answer is going to be no to any of them, but I still want to know what I'm answering.
Yeah.
Because I don't have it. I mean, I don't really know anything about these.
Mr.
issues.
Ross, you had a term of art, right? I think you said earlier that you don't use market share.
Right.
Coverage.
Market coverage.
Thank you.
And the reason for that is, unlike most businesses where it's sort of a zero sum, you divide up 100%.
Right.
Here, because issuers not only can but typically get more than one, you're not dividing up a pie of 100%. It's what your coverage of issuances in the market. So we tend to think that the term market coverage is less confusing.
Well, I just want to show you a document that was part of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. It's for the record, it's Moody's COGR 0038025 and 0038026. It goes on for several pages, but let's just focus on these first two pages. And I want you to just take a look at those two pages. And it's on credit policy. Item number three there, it says that from Ray McDaniel that the credit policy should be looking at the postmortem very carefully.
And while the witness reviews the document,
if we could for one second, Mr. Bondi is asking what the calling number is. Do you have a number?
I do. Assuming this is correct, you want to just let him know that I believe 212-527-7336 should be the Polycom that we set up for him.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. And Bondi is B-O-N-D-I.
Okay. And while the witness is reviewing the document, since you're referring to documents that you've identified as coming from the Senate subcommittee, Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, just note for the record, and not with respect to this specific document, but in with respect to some of the Moody's documents that they put in the binder that they put out, the committee, as it itself indicated at the hearing, failed to find in the document collection that they had portions of documents or where they would cut off an email, set of email communications, and did not have the cut it off with one communication and did not put in the binder the next communication, which demonstrated the exact opposite of happened of what they, the point that they were trying to prove. And there were similar issues with regard to a number of other documents. And so, as I said, not with respect to this specific document you've asked the witness to look at here, but if you're going to use their collection, we're going to need to reserve the right to make a point as to whether it's a proper document or not.
How much of the document are we going to cover?
Just the that first page right now, the first two pages. That, as you can see, it's from Ray McDaniel, and it's on the credit policy in the fall of 2007.
Well, yeah, I see the document.
Have you ever seen that document before?
Yeah, I skimmed this document. I did not read it closely. I skimmed it at the day of the hearing last week. I printed out all the materials and kind of went through them very quickly, and I had skimmed the material.
But have you seen this document back in the fall of 2007?
No, my first time seeing this was this past week.
And this is on the
My recollection. I don't remember seeing this.
And just to let the record know that this says credit policy issues.
Right. Well, the date here is October 07.
Right.
And my role in credit policy group dates from July 08.
I would imagine that. Anyway, also, if you could please take note, what is the terminology they use there? Don't they use the word market share?
I don't know,
Mr.
I know that my understanding is. I've heard that this may not be something. I don't know the context of this document, and it may not be something written from Ray McDaniel. I don't know if he wrote this cut and paste. I don't know what the origin of this text is.
So you never saw this document prior in 2007?
No.
Okay. Have we? Brett said he wanted to be. If we can go off the record for a second.
Oh, sure. It's about 10 minutes of 2, and I'll pause the recording. The time is about 1:51 p.m. This is Vic Cunicelli. We're on record again, and with the addition of Brad Bondi telephonically.
Thank you, Mr. Kenter. The document that I just showed you from the PSI committee, just wanted to make sure that I understand that you have never seen that document. You did not see that document in the fall of 2007.
I don't recall seeing this document.
And you have never seen a postmortem review of the problems in the subprime market or concerns for Moody's?
I would say the term postmortem or review and so on, we use that many times. We talk about let's do a review and let's think. So many times where, as I said, I've done presentations on lessons learned, but it wasn't a formal Moody's approved view of lessons learned.
But could you just read item number 3 on the that document, what it says right there?
Number 3 says, we will also need to conduct a careful postmortem of the experience.
So you do not know, and presumably this document came from Ray McDaniel. Again, yeah. It's addressed. It's Ray McDaniel to Ray McDaniel. I doubt, this is a conjecture, but I doubt someone just wrote an email to themselves. So this document has an unknown origin, might be copied from somewhere else. It's a longish document, not an email one would typically write for to themselves. So my conjecture is we don't know that. I don't know the history of this document. The other part on the section on market share, could you just read what it says in number six? Moody's for years has struggled with this dilemma. On the one hand, we need to win the business and maintain market share, or we cease to be relevant. On the other hand, our reputation depends on maintaining ratings quality, or at least avoiding big visible mistakes. For the most part, we hand the dilemma off to the team MDs to solve. As head of corporate ratings, I offered my managers precious few suggestions on how to address this very tough problem. Just assume that they would strike an appropriate balance.
That's enough, Mr. Cantor. Thank you for reading that. We only have one copy of that today. So, have you ever heard that type of language before? I believe you said before we went off record that the first time you saw this type of document was at the PSI hearing?
That's correct, that week.
Okay. And your predecessor never gave you any of these documents that or similar documents like this concerning postmortems or lessons learned that...
I don't remember any document like this. I mean, I was involved in you know, individual... You know, as I say, we review a variety of things, but not this kind of... nothing like this document.
Okay. Thank you. Vic?
Mr. Cantor, I made reference to the public law that initiated the commission last year. It's public law 111-21. And I'm just going to read a real quick section of it, section 5. It says... there is established in the legislative branch the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to examine the causes, domestic and global, of the current financial and economic crisis in the United States. I've got a very learned gentleman in front of me, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, and I'm not being facetious, in your estimation, what are the causes that, you know, of the financial crisis, the current financial crisis, what you see as... the most common causes, the most proximate causes?
Wow. A deep question with a potentially long answer. At the deepest level, the causes of the crisis was overconfidence in the stability of our economy, because having had such a stable economy since the early 80s. There was the general view that we are now kind of post-deep recession world. Going further into it, there was a view that monetary policy would always be able to sufficiently dampen cycles and provide a supportive role to the financial system and the economy more generally. We were in an era of secularly declining interest rates at the long end and moderate interest rates at the short end, which provided a sense of comfort in being able to finance large, possibly illiquid or maturity mismatched positions in the economy, so that created a lot of leverage and mismatching of asset liability mismatching, which created a certain vulnerability in almost every sector of the world economy.
that's at the core of that, and then the precipitant or the sector that first experienced the shock was the U.S. Mortgage market, and after a run of about 60 years of virtually always positive or non-negative home price appreciation at the aggregate level, and a period in which prices had been rising even quicker than they had at the historical average, while it was widely recognized that there would be a slowdown in home price appreciation, and in fact, typical projections around the time would be for something relatively flat or slow growth, or perhaps even very modest decline. I think in the collective view of most people in the market was that if there were to be a downward adjustment in home prices, they would be gradual, based on people's personal experience, well, the historical data and the personal experience that there seemed to be an asymmetry in home price movements, that while you could get a rapid fire increase, decreases were more likely to be gradual because of the reluctance of sellers to sell at deeply discounted prices and the adjustment in people's decisions to move in reaction to weakening real estate market fundamentals. And the other related element was, while we experienced periods of tightening and easing of borrowing environments for all classes of creditors, so we've had cyclical fluctuations in credit conditions, given the robust infrastructure of home mortgage finance in the U.S. and how it had, frankly, expanded over time, there was little expectation that we could face an environment where refinancing opportunities would vanish very quickly for the market nearly as a whole. So all those conditions put together led to concerns about risks, yes, but not the kind of outsized risks that were realized during the crisis.
Okay. The only thing you said that surprised me a bit was that the expectation was that although it had the real estate market had appreciated it, perhaps in the near term, at greater than historical rates, there was still a collective feeling that on the downside, in the event of a downside, that it would be gradual and not precipitous.
You were asking my
yes.
View. I don't know what the specific views of the areas in Moody's that were responsible for rating mortgage-backed securities or rating institutions that are heavily invested in mortgages, what their views were. I'm giving just my own impression looking back, and I look at the chart of home price appreciation and how it had been so rapid, and I'm just thinking, well, what were probably people thinking? And I'm thinking just to myself and my own personal experience and all the people that I live in New York, and I don't know if you live in a similar area, but real estate is a nonstop topic of conversation in New York, it was common in my environment outside of work, but I just view that as sort of an indicator of a broader view. People talk about high real estate prices and how they may decline some, but that I didn't know anybody who had in their mind a kind of catastrophic scenario such as we experienced.
Okay. As an academic exercise, do you think that any vehicle, any investment vehicle, should be able to be rated? I mean, is it, and I'm asking you specifically, not as you as a Moody's employee, but do you believe that any investment vehicle, purely as an academic exercise, should be rateable?
No.
Reasons, if you care to expand on that?
If I don't think there's a vehicle that's necessarily too risky or too safe to be rated, but if I knew nothing about it, it was just totally, I had no information, I had no value, my opinion was not based on anything, then I wouldn't rate it.
Okay. Well, I mean, my question was more professional than that, meaning that it's being brought before you as something that you would professionally look at. So you
right. No, I didn't. I was using colloquial terms, but that applies okay. professionally. I mean, the rating is our opinion, mm-hmm. and the ratings given, you know, is a letter rating, alphanumeric rating that has a scale, a 21-point scale. And so when we assign a rating, we're giving an opinion that, the rank order of this credit relative to a bunch of other credits we rate falls where it does on the rating scale. And if you have absolutely no information, you could say, well, I'll pick some low point on the scale, and it might be right on average, but it would not be useful to anybody. You're basically saying, I don't know, so treat it like everything else in the world that you don't know. But we need information in order to make a more precise opinion, just to say, well, on average, it should perform like everything else in the world. So we get more information, and to the extent we have more information that allows us to express an informed opinion on, you know, where we think it belongs in this universe of risks out there, that's when we would assign a rate.
Okay, so you would want a body of knowledge on any kind of vehicle to be extant before you felt comfortable rating it.
We would need to have some information to analyze for sure.
Okay.
Can I hear that?
Sure.
Mr. Ross, you have a copy of the same
collection.
If it would make it easier if we use yours while I have mine. And this is on the exhibits on the PSI investigation. On page 10, of the exhibit book, on the bottom, the subcommittee findings.
Yes. I don't think that's page 10 of the subcommittee book that you're looking at. I think it's page 10 of a memorandum that appears.
Okay.
And this is the a memorandum.
Right. The memorandum
from the two senators,
Senator Carl Levin, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Exhibit 1A.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, if you can refer to page 10. And we're not going to go over all of these, but some of these I just want to get your comments on the subcommittee's findings. On the first one, I'd like you to read that, and that's inaccurate rating models from 2004 to 2007. Could you please read that and see? I'd like your response to that, whether or not you agree or disagree or comments.
Inaccurate rating models from 2004 to 2007. Moody's and Standard & Poor's used credit rating models with data that was inadequate to predict how high-risk residential mortgages, such as subprime, interest-only, and option-adjustable rate mortgages would perform.
Can you comment on that, please?
Certainly know nothing about S&P's.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, so yes, Moody's.
I understand.
I don't know the specifics of what models or methodologies were used. I mean, I have some general sense, but not really the deep specifics of what models were used during the period. I would say that the phrase inaccurate rating models is not a meaningful phrase to me. A ratings model is a way of reviewing data and collecting it and processing it in a consistent way that captures the elements of an agreed-to methodology. That you develop a methodology which says, we think it would be helpful to evaluate, say, the risk that a pool of mortgages will experience losses of 1%, 2%, 3%. You know, there's a whole distribution of potential losses that a collateral pool could experience. And in developing a methodology, you have a number of views about how different types of, or different characteristics of loans, loans with different characteristics will perform in different circumstances. And you summarize at least one perspective of that methodology in a algorithmic model, which is a representation of how you want to consistently apply that view as you come across different collateral pools that are probably similar, broadly speaking, but different in very in specific aspects. So the model is used to compare two things that are basically pretty similar but have some differences, and you want to have a method of thinking about, well, how significant are those modest differences in collateral pools? So you have two successive transactions from the same originator, and you want to say, it's a little bit riskier. How much more risky should I, you know, do I view it? Let's use a model to help me think about it in a quantitative way.
So I just wanted to focus on your answer. Is it yes or no to the...
Oh, so I don't think the term inaccurate... Oh, so yeah, I didn't get to that. A rating model can't... I don't think it can be inaccurate. I'm not sure in how you could... If you were trying to code it up a certain way and you miscoded it, it could have a technical inaccuracy. But if a model is intended to be summarizing your views, then the model's not inaccurate.
Well, let me ask you, if you use the wrong assumptions in the model, could that make it inaccurate?
Well, the wrong assumptions. If you assume that you knew something with certainty and your assumption was wrong, then you're inaccurate. But I think in the case of the ratings process in any area, when you're making assumptions, you're talking about where you think central tendencies are, where you think the amount of the way your assumptions typically are about the direction that things are likely to take and average magnitudes. But in adopting that framework, you anticipate that none of the assumptions will prove to be correct. What you're really focused on is developing a general sense of what you think the average experience will be, and a range of experiences around the average that reflects your all the sources of your knowledge and experience.
So just to focus, would your answer be yes or no to that?
To the
question that whether rating, inaccurate rating models, whether inaccurate rating models?
I would say no.
Okay.
If I could circle back for just one second, excuse me, on something you said, models aren't necessarily inaccurate, and then Mr. Borges asked you about, well, what if your assumptions were And I think we dealt with that at a kind of a high level, but a bit earlier you said in response to my question about the causes of the crisis that, and I guess this was your personal assumption, I think you answered it on a I asked it on a personal level and you answered it on a personal level, that the housing values increased appreciably in the in the 2000s, and that you really didn't see them, you know, declining precipitously the way they had. What if that assumption made its way into the models that we were either going to have continued rapid appreciation or at least a plateau, but yet we had a precipitous decline in the values?
Well, see, the fact that people did not anticipate this steep decline in prices and it occurring at this speed would have been true in any model you were using, on any data set you might have used to train the model, to parameterize the model. So it's independent of the model. If you incorporated it as an assumption that I didn't think home prices could fall more than X, then you would have been proven that assumption would have put a floor on home prices that turned out not to be correct. But it's not specific to any model. That could have been just, you know, as I said, that concern or that issue, which is what happened in this crisis, is model free. It has nothing to do with models.
If I could just tease that a little bit, because I think you have a legitimate point there. That doesn't say that the model's necessarily accurate, but is what you are saying that the output from the model can be inaccurate? The model's still sound, but the output from it is inaccurate?
Well, the model produces a probability distribution of outcomes. So it doesn't predict what the outcome will be. It only predicts a distribution of outcome ranging from no losses to potentially 100% losses on the pools, and would associate a probability with each of them. Now, the model, by the way, doesn't determine the rating. The output of the model doesn't strictly determine the rating. But if you're just evaluating the model, normally you would say there's no way to know to see that a model doesn't have since it predicts all outcomes, a realization doesn't demonstrate a model being good or bad. I mean, you need a lot more to do that to evaluate models. But it may be the case, and I don't know, that there were no outcomes, there was no probability weight. It could have been zero on the outcomes we've experienced. In that case, you'd say the model produced a zero, but actually it probably didn't produce a zero. It probably produced just so many small decimal places it's effectively zero. What in some cases is a 7 standard deviations is in some other context, you know, or something. I just made that number up. But
sure.
But so models, since they are designed to allow to recognize all outcomes as possibilities, then models, when a particular outcome is realized, are not necessarily right or wrong. You can come back after the fact and say, you know, for many reasons, I now think, or at least going forward, I'd like to put more weight on certain outcomes than in constructing this probability distribution than I did before. And you may be wrong the next time, and maybe you'll end up putting too much weight on high loss outcomes. But models, it's not as simple. I don't see inaccurate rating models as having much meaning.
Okay, let's go to on page 11 of the memorandum on two competitive pressures. And competitive pressures, including drive for market share and need to accommodate investment bankers bringing in business, affected the credit ratings issued by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. If you can just focus on Moody's, obviously. What's your comments on
on that finding of the subcommittee?
This has not been my experience in Moody's, that competitive pressures or need to accommodate investment bankers affected the credit ratings we've issued. That's not been my experience. And most importantly, the magnitude of at which the mortgage experience was different from the view within Moody's and the view held widely elsewhere was, you know, several orders of magnitude different. So it's clear what if, you know, we could have gone back and done things differently, we would have put a high weight on an outcome that was really outside the range of our expectations.
And could you give an example of that weight?
Well, I said it was effectively zero. What we would put on it now?
Yeah.
Well, now we know it was one because it happened. So,
yeah.
So, but it is an interesting question. You know, we sit here today, and you have to think, well, if I have a pool of mortgage-backed securities, how much home price depreciation over what period of time should I put, should I allow for some meaningful probability? And we're in a different state of the world. We previously had been through a price run-up. Now we've experienced a large decline. So does that make the likelihood of this larger decline happen again smaller or greater? I think, roughly speaking, we are now thinking about magnitudes of a similar order to what we've experienced. You might argue for less because we didn't have the run-up, and so how much farther can it go? But given the additional fragility of the financial system and economy right now, there still is a possibility, and I think it's a low probability, but a much, you know, something that needs to be recognized as a realistic possibility of a dramatic further home price decline.
But just to have your direct on competitive pressures, you're saying you
nothing in my experience.
Okay. Let's jump to number five, inadequate resources. Despite record profits from 2004 to 2007, Moody's failed to assign sufficient resources to adequately rate new products and test the accuracy of the existing ratings. Do you have you ever heard of anything like that during that period?
I heard it mentioned in the Senate hearing as somebody's view, this hearing. Something's related to this. I never heard that there was inadequate resources in either of these areas. After the crisis, resources were stressed in all of Moody's and in all financial institutions in dealing with the crisis.
Did you ever hear that there was a need of hundreds of analysts to help with the enormous workflow that was
hundreds of additional analysts?
Yes.
Oh no, I have not. I did not hear of a need. I didn't hear of a need for any additional analysts.
Okay. Vic, do you have anything?
Why don't you hit them with six?
Okay.
We're going down a list.
Yeah. Okay. wanted to see if Vic Quinicelli had something to add. Number six, the mass downgrades and shock market. Could you read that? It's quite lengthy and take a moment.
Sure. Mass downgrades by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, including downgrades of hundreds of subprime RMBS.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did you want to read it out loud?
You can read it to yourself.
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Okay, I've read it.
Could you please comment on that?
We did downgrade, Moody's downgraded hundreds of securities in RMBS in July. It mentions downgrades of CDOs in October, but I believe we put those securities on review in July, so effectively notified the market that many such securities would experience downgrades. And then the next part that refers to Moody's is shocked the financial markets. Well, that's a judgment. I don't know in what sense it shocked financial markets. I do know that we had been commenting that we were reviewing the circumstances in the subprime market, and if delinquencies continued to rise above prior experience, you know, we would consider taking rating action. So I don't know whether people were surprised or not. Help cause the collapse of the subprime secondary market. I don't know anything about that, whether that's true or not. And triggered sales of assets that have lost investment grade status. I don't know if that's the case.
You don't know that that's the case, that it would have triggered, like,
yeah,
there are certain institutional investors who have to be invested in AAA, no? Who could have held some of these assets when they were AAA but were precluded?
There's a lot of discussion about holding requirements and investing requirements of financial institutions, of rated securities. I spent some time working with two academics. I employed a research firm to survey investors on their uses of ratings in, I don't know when it was, 2003, 2004, 2005 or something like that. As kind of a, you know, I have an academic background and interest in how our ratings are used, and we asked a lot of questions of I think it was 100 major asset managers in the United States and 100 in Europe. And we asked them many questions about how they used ratings, including whether they had to sell securities when downgraded to speculative grade. And a small minority of the issuers, of the investors, had to sell. They had, that's why I know I read in the press various things, but when we survey large investors, and they weren't all large investors, but we had many large investors and some smaller investors, my understanding is the requirement to sell according to investors' own guidelines, which these are not. They're investor guidelines, they're guidelines they choose for themselves, but the forced sell is not that common.
And if I could just circle back with you for 1 second, you said that you, in your background, you studied a lot, you know, how our, I guess, Moody's ratings are used. Do you think that your ratings, Moody's ratings, are misused?
Well, I don't really know. there's a lot of people in the world that use our ratings in lots of ways. I think generally people have, you know, used the ratings in a useful way. When people say they used ratings in particular ways in a newspaper article, it might sound like they had misused it, but it's a big generalization.
Right. I mean, because what you're actually rating, you're rating, you know, the credit ability. You're telling people the likelihood of default and the severity of default in the event that it happens. Correct? Do you think? I'm sorry.
I'm agreeing with your premise. I'm not at you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought you were stopping.
No.
No.
Do you think that there's a lot of misunderstanding in the market that you do due diligence, or Moody's, or that it, even though you're in your literature, you say this is we're rating credit. Do you believe that there is a common misunderstanding?
And I don't know whether There were some market participants that thought we did due diligence on the loan originations in a mortgage-backed security. There may have been some. I would be surprised if many of the large investors thought that, but I don't really have, I haven't asked them that directly. It'd be highly unusual, though, because we're not a due diligence firm. We rate corporate securities. Corporate securities, one of the key ingredients to our methodologies of rating corporate securities is to review the financial statements prepared by those corporations. We do not do any due diligence on those documents. I doubt investors think we do. People I think are aware that we analyze the information provided by those in the marketplace whose job it is to produce that raw information, and that's what our ratings are based on.
Okay. It seemed, I reviewed some emails, and it seemed like it was a reasonably common theme between yourself and a couple of people of, this is what we're up against, that,
in the
people don't understand our ratings or what we're rating.
Okay, there were different, there was a period of time where people were relating ratings to an expectation that price stability would pertain to any security that carried a very high rating. And while the mortgage-backed securities, very many of them ultimately defaulted, and so the ratings did not perform as we expected at various times during the crisis, many securities that carried high ratings for Moody's carried very low market values as well, even though their credit quality in a default risk sense had not been very significantly reduced.
Okay. I'm sorry. I stepped on you, Tom.
That's okay. I don't have any further questions on that page, but if counsel could give you a couple of sheets of paper, I'd like to ask a question. Could you put on a sheet of paper the names of analysts that were terminated that you know of from 2000 to 2009?
I don't need a sheet of paper. I don't know anyone who was terminated. 2000
from 2000 and 2009. Do you have any names for us?
And that could be separated in lieu of demotion or transfer.
Let's keep that separate for the record.
Okay.
Let's just.
What's the time frame?
From 2000 to 2009. For the record, I believe we covered 2000 to 2001 earlier, and you said there were none.
Yeah, I'm pausing for a reason that's very insignificant for you. I would only know the detailed employment experience of people that reported to me. I had a computer programmer, a junior computer programmer who worked on nothing to do with ratings, and he was not performing well, and we went through a series of evaluations and steps to communicate his poor performance, and we did end up separating, and I'm trying to recall exactly the nature of that final separation, but I'm sure it's of not significance to you, but I'm trying to give you a complete answer.
No, we were just trying to get a list of names of any analyst that was fired over that period of time.
Right. I wouldn't know people's...
How about analysts that were transferred to other groups?
Do I know analysts that were transferred to other groups? Wow. We could be here all day.
Okay, so I think were any of these analysts transferred to other groups for their lack of ability or performance?
I don't know of any analysts that were transferred to another group because of poor performance. I don't know that.
Something that was a topic of discussion at PSI, I believe twice, I believe, with Yuri, I'm sorry, her name?
Yoshizawa.
Yoshizawa, Yoshizawa, I believe. And with Mr. Michalik, Richard Michalik, there was talk of analysts being removed from deals. Did you see the PSI hearings?
I did see okay. that part of the hearing.
You saw that part of the hearing? Was that the first time you heard of that subject, or were you familiar with that?
That was the first time I heard of the subject.
Okay. So you never supervised analysts?
No.
Okay. And if you never supervised them, you never would have had occasion to remove an analyst from a deal or...
No.
Okay.
Okay, I'd like to show you another document here. The subject is a correlation for CDOs of ABS. It's a series of emails. You don't have to go through all the emails, but maybe the first 2.5 pages, you could take as much time as you'd like to review it. I actually have a couple of copies.
From whom to whom?
It's from Eric Kolchinski to Andrew Kimball.
And tell them what's the date on that?
The date is November 3rd, 2008, and prior. Series of emails, but if you could focus on the first 2.5 pages.
It's a pretty complex document. Give me a hint of what you're looking for me to comment on, so I'll read it with that eye.
Well, if we go to the October 31st from Andrew Kimball to Eric Kolchinski. Eric, actually, I would ask a variant on Nicholas's question. Do you think rating agencies can reasonably rate...
Page 3.
Mm-hmm. ABS, CDOs, but at the same time, level lower than AAAs. If so, what level?
Yeah.
Can you give us... your impression of that? Do you agree with that? If you could follow up with...
Do I agree with a question?
No. Follow up with Eric Kolchinski's comments on October 31st, Friday.
Yeah.
No, here. You see there, Andy, on page 2?
Oh, yeah, okay, right. Okay. Maybe we should know the context of the whole discussion. Is that...
You want to take a moment?
I think it's not fair to make me answer that question without looking at the underlying email.
Yeah, why don't you take a moment?
Yeah, take as much time as you like.
And it looks like there's an attachment to this as well.
That's not printed with it.
No.
Is it being referenced? Do we have that?
No, we do not.
Well, it's a complex document. I can't say I've mastered every sentence in it.
Right.
But I have a good sense of it. I may need to refer to it if you ask me too specific question, but what's your question?
The question is, do you believe CDOs can be effectively rated, especially during this time that Eric Kaczynski was preparing this memo?
Well, again, the language, you know, what people mean by can be rated needs some discussion, first of all. One could choose to assign the lowest rating to a transaction, and that rating would never be too high. Could be low, could be too low. And you could assign the highest rating. You could say my criteria for getting to the highest rating is it has to be, the collateral of the security has to be 99% cash and 1% structured finance transactions. So the question, can something be rated?
If we could. Academically, that's a perfectly legitimate point. Working for Moody's, I don't think you'd last long in the market, or I think Fitch would get pretty big pretty fast if you operated from that perspective. So I mean,
I don't want to accept the premise. I don't want to finish my point.
Go ahead.
From an academic perspective, yes, you can rate it. I don't know exactly the context of what was meant by the person who asked the question, or the person who responded to the question, and all the conditions under, what do you mean, can you rate it? I saw some language about can you rate it. There was some language about that Eric provided. I think he said something like, I think you can, but over time, such and such and such and such. So I think what he was thinking that in this, you know, I believe that as sort of an ongoing long-term recommendation, that I think what he said is, for now, I don't think we have a stable methodology that we could implement that we could comfortably rely on over a long period of time, because over time it may not prove to be as effective over time as when you initially instituted. I think that's what he said. Okay, and that's an interesting perspective. Which means another way of interpreting it is, I think you could for now, but you'd have to be careful to make sure, you would have less confidence of whether that model would be reliable over time. I think that's what he said. I didn't see how Mr. Kimball responded to that, but that's what I think he said.
Okay, thank you. If you could just pass back those copies. Brad, do you have some questions?
Is Mr. Bondi still with us? Maybe not. I know he said he was going to put it on.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, Brad, do you have any questions? It's Vic Cunicelli. Tom opened up to you. Do you have any questions?
Hi, Mr. Cantor. How are you? I appreciate your time today.
Sure.
And I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. I had a family commitment that prevented me from joining. I had a question, and I don't believe this has been covered, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but can you tell me a little bit about the culture at Moody's? Corporations seem to have different types of culture, and can you tell me a little bit about how you viewed the culture at Moody's?
Yeah. I have limited professional experience, so I know really only what I've heard about different parts of the banking industry, and so I've met some professionals, of course, in my capacities here at Moody's, but I don't know that much about aspects of the banking industry. My own personal background is that I worked in academia for 4 years, and at the Federal Reserve for 4 years. And when I decided to make a change, for 10 years, and when I decided to leave the Federal Reserve after 10 years, I was looking for a firm and an industry, but predominantly a firm, which had the kind of culture
that I enjoyed. And frankly, I wasn't looking for a change in culture. I was looking to maintain the culture that I'd enjoyed in academia and in the Federal Reserve. I'm an economist by background. And one in which we felt that the people working there felt we were working for something that was good for society, that it was an environment in which intellectual discourse was rewarded, and I would have a chance, frankly, to succeed in an area where I personally felt I excelled, was sort of in analytics and questioning everybody and everything. And in coming to Moody's, I felt I had found a perfect match, that the people at Moody's were much like me, and I felt I had a fairly rapid ascent in the company because those qualities that I came to Moody's with were highly valued and rewarded.
And did that culture at Moody's ever change during your tenure?
No.
Okay. And tell me, you mentioned doing something that's good for society. Can you explain to me why ratings are good for society?
Well, there's a lot of information out there in the market about securities. It's a lot of information for people to process, and they, I think, benefit from aids which help them process information in summary manners for different purposes. The typical use in a rating of ratings, that, in my experience, would be the people who purchase assets typically do a lot of research and analysis to support their buy-sell decision, their selling assets. But there are many other people who are interested in what those people are doing. And at times they will ask, you know, I'm the chief credit officer of a bank, and a banker comes to me and says, I want to make a loan to this corporation, and I think we can get this spread. And they, you know, now here's my underwriting package. And before the chief credit officer decides how much to delve into that, you know, because he's responsible for kind of double checking what his loan underwriter, in this case, or loan officer, is doing, he might say, well, where's the stock trading on that firm? You know, has it fallen a lot recently? Where are the spreads on that firm? What's the rating on that firm? And so on. So there's a list of summary measures that people who, frankly, the people who are usually a step or two away from the buy-sell process usually look to help them think about how much time they're going to invest kind of second-guessing or closely reviewing the people who are really their agents. Because what we have in our society is most people are investing through somebody else. And that creates a principal-agent problem. And the people who, you know, are hiring those agents who say, go out, make me a lot of money. Make me a lot of money, but don't take any risk. Or, you know, or don't only invest this way or that way, and so on. So they look for tools, you know, so don't invest in anything where the stock price recently fell a lot, or is trading too wide, or has too low a rating. So we're part of a fabric of information for kind of the people who are a few steps removed from the actual transactional process. And that's always an imperfect process because you can't duplicate. The whole point is you've hired somebody to do some work for you, and yet you don't want to duplicate all their work. You might as well do it yourself. So that's where we fit in the process, and we help save those people some work that they don't reproduce everybody's work.
So do you think retail investors rely on ratings?
I don't know if retail investors rely, or any retail investors rely on ratings. They are not our, certainly not the focus of what we do, the people we talk to, and where our communications are targeted. We're very much an institutionally oriented firm.
Do any investors rely on ratings?
Well, I mean, rely is, it's a technical term. Do people consider ratings? I would hope they would consider them. Would they rely on them in the sense that that forms the basis of their buy-sell decisions? I would expect not.
Mm-hmm. You described earlier, too, in your answer about joining Moody's, and I'm paraphrasing you, so I'll let the record reflect exactly what you said, but you wanted to be at a place where you could question everyone and everything. Is that basically what you said?
Yes.
Okay. And that's what you believed you had at Moody's. You could question decisions. You could question people's decisions. You could question models. Is that what you felt like you had?
Yes.
Okay. And what would happen if you didn't have a situation where an employee at Moody's, say an analyst, wasn't able to question a decision or a model? What would that mean? What would that happen?
I can't imagine the circumstance where you couldn't question a decision or model.
And if you couldn't question a decision or a model at Moody's, that wouldn't be a good thing for the ratings, would it?
I'm sorry. I can't imagine a situation. I've never heard of a situation where someone couldn't question a model or a rating. I don't even understand the premise of the question. In my experience, there's constant questioning of our methodologies and our ratings. In fact, I'm not sure what the hypothetical. It's very hard to go beyond the hypothetical there. Or what is the hypothetical?
I'm just asking a simple question. If employees were not permitted to question a decision or a rating, that wouldn't be a good thing for ratings, would it?
It wouldn't be a good thing for the company altogether. It's the antithesis of what we're about.
And do ratings need to be independent from business decisions? And let me explain that. Do ratings need to be independent from the decisions that Moody's makes with respect to its own business and revenue?
Ratings are independent from business considerations.
And why do they need to be independent?
Well, we think it's in our best interest as a firm. I mean, let me take a step back. Ultimately, the policies we adopt are to strengthen our business. So all the investments we make, both material and cultural investments, to produce the highest quality ratings is to support our business. So at the core, the whole ratings process is driven by business considerations, to strengthen our reputation, the preference of investors to see Moody's ratings and understand Moody's ratings and research, and to have those preferences lead the market to demand Moody's ratings. So it's all about business, yes, all about the highest quality ratings in order to promote our business interests.
And by highest quality ratings, do you mean correct ratings?
I mean, is independently determined, independent in the sense that the analysts are basing their information, their ratings, only on credit-relevant information. And the ratings are opinions, to use the most informed, intelligent, analytical perspectives that can be gathered and processed to deliver the best quality opinion.
But what I'm asking about is this independence. What is the independence from?
The independence would be from any distraction from the objective of trying to identify where a credit's risk falls on a relative scale that we have as our rating system. We have many potentially distractive elements that could influence, inappropriately influence opinions. We have complaints from every quarter of the world about everything we do, whether it's the press or the government or the investor community or the investment banking community or you name it. We get it from everywhere. And what we try to do is put the blinders on and focus on the task at hand. And frankly, that's, you know, been the only way we could have survived this long, and it's the key to our future for sure.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the distractions that you've described?
Potential distractions?
Mm-hmm. What potential distractions does Moody have to guard against?
In my experience, junior analysts, you know, have been most susceptible to you know, raising. You know, I have to say, you know, these are people. You're dealing with thousands of people, and you know, I talk about a culture, and we achieve a culture over time, and by people learning from the senior people. So, you know, all sorts of things could be said, thought, and it has to be learned. So I would have a junior analyst or some analyst might say, you know, could be concerned about, you know, I mean, you know, I don't know. I take a hypothetical. We had yesterday the prime ministers of Germany and France said they were going to investigate rating agencies because of their recent ratings assigned in Europe. Okay, so if somebody were to say to me at our next rating committee on a European country, well, what about the implications for what's going on in that you know, European brouhaha? I would say that's not relevant to our decision making today. So those are the kinds of things, you know, because frankly, things are in newspapers all the time. People, you know, it is a challenge to maintain that independence and stay with what's in the room.
And these sorts of distractions that we just gave an example of, they're distractions that could take away from the quality of ratings, is that correct?
They could.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, would taking a junior analyst off of a deal based on complaints from an investment bank, Would that be a distraction, perhaps, to other analysts that might affect the quality of ratings?
Well, it's a very big hypothetical. Let me just give a complete answer. I'm sorry, because we discussed briefly, maybe you weren't on the call, that I had never heard of anyone being removed from a transaction. So for me, it's a totally hypothetical, but I do want to answer the hypothetical. I heard the discussion at the Senate hearing of this topic, and my only response was that an analyst who was engaged in a highly confrontational or some sort of problematic relationship would be somebody I might be concerned could be distracted by something that wasn't relative to the credit. But I don't, you know, just as a matter of what is the distraction? The distraction, we don't want personal relationships to be distractions either. So we definitely do remove, you know, members from committees who are conflicted. Now, and if you had a personal antipathy or difficulty with somebody, I would expect somebody to recuse themselves. Having said that, I don't think we've ever had a situation where somebody needed to do that. But that would be another potential distraction, would be a personal relationship, positive or negative, with a party to a transaction.
And that's a potential distraction that could affect the quality of ratings.
Well, it's something I would think about if it were to ever come up. Never came up in my experience. I'm just giving you, we're talking in the range of hypotheticals.
I'm not asking you to say whether this occurred or didn't occur. I'm just asking you, is this a potential distraction that could affect the quality of the ratings?
Well, given that we have a committee process and no single vote, would determine an outcome, it wouldn't affect the quality of the ratings, no, in that particular thing.
And would market share being shown to analysts and managing directors by a group managing director, would that be a potential distraction that could affect the quality of the ratings?
I don't believe so.
Okay. What if an employee is told to generate more revenue? Is that a potential distraction that could affect the quality of the ratings?
It would certainly depend on the context of that statement. Certainly there are plenty of ways to that one might generate revenue or be involved in revenue that would have nothing to do with ratings. So I don't have any way to respond.
Is it a potential distraction? You don't think it's even a potential distraction?
You have to have a context. If the context and the message is ratings quality is the primary objective, and if people have secondary objectives, that should not be a distraction.
Let me ask you this. Is a general fear among employees that they could lose their job if they lose a deal? A general fear that they could lose their job if they lose a deal. Is that a potential distraction that could take away from the quality of ratings?
If they lose a deal, I'm not exactly sure how you would lose a deal or how one loses deals, but if people are fearing of losing their job, it can influence their behavior in order not to lose a job. But I don't know of any such circumstances.
So wouldn't you agree that that could be a potential distraction to the quality of the ratings?
If a person is told they might lose their job by producing the highest quality ratings, that they should do something other than produce the highest quality ratings. If someone were told to do something that was contradictory to that objective, that would compromise the quality of the ratings. If someone was told, sacrifice the quality of the ratings in order to achieve another objective, that would be potentially a risk to the quality of the ratings.
Now, Moody's is a public company, correct?
That's correct.
It has shareholders, right?
That's correct.
Part of a public company's duty is to maximize shareholder wealth from your days in academia, correct?
That's correct.
Yet, Moody's, as you described, also was designed to serve, I believe it was your words, some good for society, a public good. Correct?
Well, no. Moody's was designed to maximize shareholder wealth. What I said is we have a happy coincidence that in achieving shareholder wealth, like if you were I don't want to put myself in some, overly wonderful industry, but if your objective was to cure cancer, but you have a company that says cure cancer, we'd say you would be both trying to maximize shareholder wealth and do some good for the society. The objective is to maximize shareholder wealth. The way to achieve that is to produce the highest quality ratings in research. And frankly, the damage to our reputation of the recent crisis, whether deserved or not, has severely impacted the value of the franchise and reinforced the long-held view at Moody's that the core of the franchise value and shareholder wealth is embedded in the quality of our ratings.
Mm-hmm. And a reputation is something that's built over time. Is that true? A corporate reputation over time?
That's my belief.
Mm-hmm. And Hal, from I'd be interested to know your views on how you see potentially conflicts existing between a building a long-term reputation and short-term goals, perhaps short-term earnings goals. How is Moody's? Were there conflicts between short-term earnings goals and more long-term reputational goals?
I'm not aware of conflicts of that sort.
Mm-hmm. How do you minimize, in your view, conflicts or distractions, to use your earlier term? How do you minimize distractions for employees?
Well, the analyst has a fairly narrowly constrained job, and they're involved in ratings and research of a set of issuers or an asset class in structured finance. They have no involvement in the revenue side of the business in any way. They only deal with analytical issues. Their compensation is based on their own evaluation and the aggregate performance of the firm. Those are the key measures. And we also, that's a key measure.
And you said no involvement in the revenue side. Do you think they should know about the revenue side and how much money is being made? The junior analysts that are rating deals, do you think they should be told about how much money Moody's is making?
Well, we have a public filing, so do I think it's a problem that we have a public filing? I don't think it's a concern.
No. Let me clarify that, because I'm not talking about the public filing. Do you think management should tell the analyst exactly how much revenue they or their groups are generating?
We don't have any communications today to our teams about revenue, or the analysts have no such communications. There may have been in the past such communications. I think those communications did not affect the ratings process, as far as I can tell. But in the course of our efforts to strengthen our analytical processes and independence, we have taken measures to stop sharing any sort of information about revenues with the analytical teams. And I think it's a good thing. It can't be a bad thing to stop. So it's a further strengthening. So I think it's a good thing that we've decided to do to not continue sharing any information. I don't know to what extent information was shared. I was never given any information. Certainly as an analyst, I never had any information. I don't know what information managers specifically had, but I think it's a good thing to limit the information to those that only have a need to know.
If it's a good thing to limit information from management to junior analysts about revenue, would the converse be true, that it's a bad thing to tell junior analysts about revenue and market share and that sort of information?
I think it's kind of in the realm of belt and suspenders. We had many practices in this company and many elements of the company that gave me great confidence and pride in the integrity of our ratings process, and but ideas to help and add to it are always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And is that because revenue information might be rightfully or wrongfully misperceived by junior analysts if they're told that information by management?
Anything's possible. We certainly recognize that people outside of Moody's have come to have this view, so that it could be. So if for no other reason, to have our institutional framework, you know, fully, you know, more accurately match the public's expectations and meet the public concerns, it's an easy decision for us to make this adjustment, which we did, so I think it's a good thing. Do I think it was a necessary thing to preserve the quality of the ratings? As I said earlier, I had confidence in the process we had before that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Borgers, my colleague, asked me a few minutes ago about employees who were terminated. Analysts or managing directors in the RMBS CDO space is what I'm interested in. And my question is simply, do you know of any managing director or analyst, or have you heard of any managing director or analyst in the RMBS or CDO space who were terminated or who were asked to resign at all? Do you know any of them?
No.
Do you know of any of that situation occurring?
No. I should say, I know there were reductions in staff that occurred. I don't know the names of people. We did some shrinkage of our workforce, I believe, in 2008 or so. But I don't know anything more about that than what was published in our annual report.
Mm-hmm. Were you part of the subprime task force or subprime working group?
Yes, subprime working group.
Mm-hmm. What was the subprime working group?
We discussed this earlier today. The subprime working group was effectively an email box. There may have been a couple early meetings, but effectively it was to exchange information, but it's sort of an email box where communication was shared about things we were publishing on during the crisis. About various markets so that people in different areas would be aware of what different groups at Moody's were saying so that we were on a similar, that we were similar messaging, that we weren't saying one thing in one side of the firm and another on another. If we had disagreements, we would want to find out, you know, come to agreement about what our collective view was rather than sending confusing messages. Sometimes people would identify interesting commentary elsewhere to circulate among groups. In Moody's, the practice has always been to share information with interested colleagues and when planning to publish, to seek comments from interested colleagues. And in the crisis, as it unfolded, the number of relevant parties to information and potential commentary expanded because the scope of what we were dealing with cut across more parts of the company than before. So we were trying to set up an efficient communications network to distribute a commentary for both internal and external communication.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you got a pretty good bird's eye view of matters going on leading up to, or at least during the crisis. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, once the crisis was kind of affecting multiple parts of the firm, and we were emailing things around a lot and meeting in groups rather than cut and pasting a lot of email addresses into the same into your email, we developed a mailbox indicator for a large number of participants.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cantor, did Moody's make any mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis? We'll start off with a yes or no.
Moody's gave, you know, did our best to provide opinions on all the sectors we rated, you know, with the information we had available to us. And subsequently to the crisis, we have learned to think about other things that we didn't emphasize as much in our analysis, so we've enhanced our processes. But so we're always improving. We're a learning organization. For 100 years, every time we go through an experience, we learn from that experience. And our ratings are estimates of the likelihood, or relative risk of default. And after every default, unless we rated it at our lowest rating category when it first. When we first was issued, if it was anything higher than our lowest rating category, it subsequently defaulted. You know, we may ask ourselves, could we have done something better to get a lower rating? Most securities don't default, and then we ask ourselves, should we have rated that higher? So we're always evaluating what ratings we assigned and why, and what lessons we can learn from it.
And Mr. Cantor, forgive me, but I'm just was trying to get a yes, no, or a maybe answer. I didn't hear whether or not you thought Moody's made any mistakes leading up to the crisis or during the financial crisis.
We underestimated the risk of a mortgage market collapse, which in hindsight is a mistake. We would have preferred to have had put a higher probability on what did occur. I would have wished we had.
Okay, did Moody's, to your knowledge, make any other mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis?
Mr. Bondi, it's Sharon Nellis, and obviously I'll let Mr. Cantor answer your question, but I do want to note that we've spent a lot of time on this morning, and I'm concerned that Mr. Cantor is shorthanding, so I just want to remind, I want to do it again fully, so we don't end up with a half record in the back end.
I don't want a half record. What I want is I want a list. And we can, we're happy if you believe any of these answers are shorthand. We're happy if you want to add to that list. But let's go down the list. You listed one mistake. What other mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis do you believe that Moody's made?
Again, I will object to the word mistake. Okay, we're in the opinion business. That is what we do. We have opinions. We base our opinions on the best of the information available to us and the best of our analytical ability. And so when an opinion turns out when reality turns out different from the opinion, I don't view that as a mistake, but I do view a lesson to be learned from that about how I can hope to have more useful opinions going forward.
Mm-hmm. So, do you believe then that Moody's, other than the mistake that you just identified a few minutes ago, do you believe that Moody's made any other mistake?
Yeah, Mr. Bondi, I think repeating your insistence that Mr. Cantor said something that he didn't say does not make this go any quicker. Mr. Cantor explained that he objected to the use of the term mistake.
The record is clear. This is not a deposition. This is an interview. I'd appreciate it if you didn't interrupt me. My question to you is just, and maybe the answer is no, we didn't make any mistakes because these were all opinions, and you can't make mistakes in opinions. But I just would like to know the answer to the question of, did Moody's make any mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis, in your opinion?
I have heard people use the term mistake in many different ways, and I'm going to ask you to define the word as you think it means, and I will give an answer to your question.
Rather than me define it, I'd love to know what you think a mistake is. What's a mistake?
To me, a mistake is when you should have known something or done something with the information you had available to you, and you didn't do it?
Okay, using your definition of a mistake, did Moody's make any mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis?
No.
Okay. Do you know what an error is?
Yes.
Okay. What is an error?
I guess I was using error and mistake similarly. An error, I was using it similarly. That, you know, you have an arithmetic problem, it has a correct answer, and you should have known the correct answer. That's an error.
Mm-hmm.
2 + 2 = 5 is an error.
2 + 2 = 5. Did Moody's leading up to or during the financial crisis make any errors?
No.
Now you've said hindsight is 20/20. In hindsight, with the information you know now, looking back, with that information, did Moody's make any errors leading up to or during the financial crisis with the information you know now?
Are you changing the definition of error since Mr. Cantor said that he was defining error the same way as mistakes and it was dependent on information available at the time?
I'll tell you what. Well, what we'll do is we're gonna bear with me, please. Looking at the dictionary defines a mistake as an error in action, calculation, opinion, or judgment caused by poor reasoning, carelessness, or insufficient knowledge. Let's take that definition of mistake. Insufficient knowledge. Did Moody's make any mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis?
Not that I'm aware.
Okay. Was there any information now that you wish you had leading up to the financial crisis?
There's always information available later that would be useful prior if you'd had it. So I would not say no to that question. I would love to know what happened today. I would love to have known that before.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of information that we know today would have been useful to you leading up to the financial crisis?
Well, I would have loved to have known that wholesale investment banks posting secured collateral, security as collateral, would have difficulty funding themselves. That'd be an example I would love to know.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know that home prices were going to fall in the aggregate in the United States by 35%. I would love to know that there was going to be a bailout of the financial system, with the exception of Lehman Brothers. I would love to, and WaMu.
Can I pause you there?
Yeah.
Why would you have wanted to know that?
Because we assign ratings, which are opinions about the future, you know, risk of losses on securities, and those securities include securities issued by Lehman and WaMu, and then other institutions such as AIG and Citigroup, for example, who were bailed out.
except for their preferred stock. So I'd love to know all these things that happened afterwards, which is to say some securities performed, and paid off investors full, and some did not. And if I knew that in advance, I would rate those securities really highly, because that's what I'm trying to indicate to investors. And if I knew it, ones that were going to lose money, I'd rate them really low. So that's, that would make me prescient, and that would give me a lot of reputational kick and enhance the value of the firm and my personal record in Moody's.
Okay. I interrupted your list. Please continue.
Well, we were talking about home prices performance.
What information you would like to know
right
then that you know?
Yeah, I would have liked to have known about the speed and the magnitude of the home price decline. I would have also liked to have known in advance the speed at which refinancing opportunities would disappear for much of the market. Those are the primary things I'd like to have known.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the list is endless, but...
I appreciate that. One thing you didn't mention is the existence or spread of fraud in the housing market, and fraud has a lot of definitions. So I will use the most broad meaning of fraud, such as fraud by the borrower to get in the house. I think some folks have referred to that as fraud for housing, fraud by a lender. Some folks have referred to that as fraud by profit. And then there could be, of course, predatory lending. Is the existence or rate of that sort of behavior information that you would like to have known then that you might have an understanding about now?
Well, I would like to have known it then. I'm not sure I know it all now, but I was certainly more information about that be useful. I think the primary way it might have been useful in the big picture was for thinking about the magnitude and speed by which housing prices could collapse. I mean, because the main concern is really how far the prices and how fast they would fall. I think if one put the dots together, a high level of fraud in the industry increased the risk of a large price decline. I mean, with hindsight, because for many of these securitizations in the market, without the price decline, the issues of fraud were definitely relevant, but we would not, would not have had the crisis, obviously, without the price decline.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and this is a topic we did cover, spend some time on, in response to Mr. Borges' questions, I believe, this morning.
Okay. Well, I certainly don't want to repeat that, and I appreciate your time, Mr. Cantor. I was interested in knowing just generally what your views were on that. And I'm curious to know, is a rating something that is accurate or inaccurate because it is an opinion?
A rating can't be judged as inaccurate or accurate as it is an opinion. That's correct. It's not something that is accurate or inaccurate. It's an opinion.
Mm-hmm. Is it an opinion with respect to the degree of risk associated with an investment?
Yes.
Okay. And I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that a AAA rating means that it has the smallest degree of risk. Is that true?
It has a very low level of risk, yes.
Okay. And what is a low level of risk?
Well, we have historical statistics on how
securities with different rating levels have performed with respect to defaults and losses. And while we don't know, you know, how our ratings will perform going forward in a kind of pure statistical sense, in the sense that, you know, if we enter into the Great Depression, everything's going to have higher risk associated with it. If we go through some very favorable period, everything will have lower risk. But the within the you know, the rating scale, we still expect a rank ordering to be to hold in all those environments. And if you ask me going forward, what is my best guess of what the risk would be, I look to our historical data and say, well, I don't have a reason. Well, where I stand today, I might have a reason to think the future is different from the past. But in normal circumstances, I say, well, the past is a reasonable, you know, my reasonable best guess of what the future would be for the average experience. It would be in fact that it would be my guide to what future is likely to be, and then we will see.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I'm trying to understand, though, with this idea and this concept of the smallest degree of risk, are there any benchmarks, though, as to what is a smallest degree of risk?
Well, as I said, the quantitative benchmarks. The key benchmark is the historical performance data, which my group has produced over many, many years. And that's a benchmark in the sense that we say, if you're assigning ratings today that you think are likely to have very different outcomes today, you think today there you expect them to have different outcomes than the past, you're probably, you know, we should talk about that. Because we sort of assign ratings to our best guess to think they will perform similarly as in the past. Now, when I say similarly in the past, even in our corporate ratings areas, we have wide swings in the loss experience of BAA securities, single A securities, AA securities from 1 5-year period to the next. So I'm saying we expect a lot of variations over cycles. But when we assign the ratings, we're thinking right now, knowing what I know now, I'm expecting something similar going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the critical benchmarks.
Okay. So when we talk about opinions of ratings, there are some benchmarks that are used, correct?
Yes. Help us frame our opinions, yes.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if I'm a rater, an analyst, excuse me, and I look at a security and, you know, I see defaulting left and right, and I say, in my opinion, I still think this is a AAA. And nothing with that sort of default probability and that sort of performance has ever been given a AAA. That wouldn't be an opinion as an analyst that would go out of Moody's. It would be put into the benchmarks as to what is considered a AAA, run through the models, go through a model committee. There is some continuity, some benchmarks as to what is a AAA. Is that correct?
I think there were a number of statements in your discussion there that frankly don't sort of describe the ratings process or what we rate completely.
I wasn't meaning to describe the process. What I was asking is, if I am a junior analyst, I can't just say something is AAA without some sort of benchmark, without running it through the model, correct?
First of all, as a junior analyst, you can't assign a rating. No junior analyst assigns ratings. We have rating committees. But so we have a wide group of people involved. But in the process of assigning ratings by committee, in some areas we have models as tools. In some areas we don't use explicit models as tools. But it represents a judgment made by a group of people with quantitative data, sometimes with models that may be an important part of the ratings process, may be a side issue to the ratings process, but also looked at as a wide variety of circumstances in which a group of people evaluating an issuer or a transaction reach an opinion about the rating. And with respect to the quantitative benchmarks for the meaning of the ratings, if someone were to say, you know, I'd like to assign, I recommend that we assign a BAA rating to this security that will mature within 5 years, and we, you know, there's a common understanding of what that generally means for most people in the committee, but if for somebody said, yeah, I'd like to assign a BAA rating, I think it has a 5 basis points probability of loss to investors, I would, or anyone else in the committee would say, no, that's such a low loss, you should assign a higher rating, I don't understand your recommendation. Or similarly, if I think the security will lose for investors on average 10% of the time, they say, no, BAA is more around 1 or 2% historically, so if you're at 10, you should be thinking about a lower rating. So the benchmark is in thinking about when we assign the ratings, it's an opinion about what we think the risk of loss is, and we, you know, look to this historical experience to get a rough. It's not always exact, but it's, you know, did we come to an agreement? It's in this range.
So it's like an educated opinion.
Well, the broad opinion is educated opinion, and but the meaning of the rating scale is you know, informed by the historical experience of the ratings in those categories.
I see. What is the life expectancy of a rating?
Wow. I know that sounds pretty human. What's an anthropomorphism? We assign ratings, and then we monitor the ratings over time, so they go up or down as conditions unfold for ratings. So, you know, typical rating on average 25 to 30 in normal times, 25% of all ratings move each year. That's a big average, and of course in crisis times much higher percentages, and in various industries at various times, much higher percentages, in other cases, lower percentages.
So the life...
The life... So
forgive the colloquial term, life expectancy, but I'll continue to use it simply because I don't know the technical term, Mr. Cantor, but the life expectancy of a rating could vary. Is that what you're saying, depending on conditions?
Well, I mean, I view the life of the rating is for the whole life of the security, that each day the rating is potentially reevaluated every day, so it's always our current rating until we change the rating. And I was saying that the frequency with which ratings are changed in the average, and that covers up a tremendous amount of variation by sector and situation, but is about 25-28% of ratings are changed each year over decades, as, you know, experience. I don't view that as the extinguishment of life of a security. That's part of the life of a rating is its changes over time.
Is it comparable to compare a AAA on a structured product with a AAA on corporate debt?
It's appropriate to compare them, yes.
And would the life expectancy of a AAA on a corporate debt be comparable to the life expectancy on a structured product security?
Mm.
Could they be?
Well, it's very hard to make predictions about the likelihood of rating changes. I was reporting to you the historical average change. So when you say expectancy, it's kind of like there is something to expect. I would only have expectations based on, you know, historical averages, but again, circumstances could change. It is the case that for many years, structured finance AAAs were more stable than corporate AAAs. But we've gone through a period now where a large fraction of AAAs
in structured finance were downgraded. So you have a period of tremendous stability and a period of large instability, although in many sectors of structured finance, the AAAs have remained stable even through the crisis.
Okay.
But the mortgage market, anything touching the mortgage market was very vulnerable because unlike corporations where, you know, corporations in the medical services market and financial institutions and you name it across the board, they're not as, you know, they don't have a common driver of performance. But what happened in mortgage-related market is the key driver of performance, which was shared by so many securities, moved them all, most of them, in the same direction at the same time, which we, to that extent, we would expect that. We expected that going in. If there was an extreme movement in the mortgage market, many securities ratings in the mortgage market would move at the same time in the same direction. Because they're similar securities.
I see. And this question I have, and hopefully you can help me understand this concept or this statement, and I've read where a rating of a corporate bond by, say, IBM will exist irrespective of whether a bond it issues is rated or not rated. By contrast, it's been described to me that structured products like CDOs only exist as a practical term if they receive a rating or ratings through the structure, like a CDO, if the tranches are rated. As a practical matter, a rating is essential, is required for a structured product like a CDO. I've heard this described. Is that an accurate description? And can you help me understand if ratings are necessary as a practical matter for a CDO to exist?
Oh, sorry. I don't know whether, when you say a CDO, a structured vehicle, a special purpose vehicle that has assets and distributes cash flows from assets to different parties. I don't know how many of those exist in the world. There could be, for all I know, a gazillion. I don't know. There are structured finance, special purpose vehicles that issue securities that are bought by institutional investors. And a high proportion of securities bought by institutional investors carry ratings from various rating agencies. And similar to how in the corporate market, securities issued by corporate by large corporates are typically carry ratings from some rating agencies. So it's parallel that securities offerings in the corporate and the structured arenas often carry ratings. And if they don't have ratings, historically my understanding is there's a smaller market of investors who are likely to purchase those offerings. Parallel.
I see. And would it is a rating given? I'll strike that. As a practical matter, though, are ratings important for CDOs in order to sell the CDOs? Do you know? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, as I was saying, I think most securities carry ratings in the marketplace. Not all. So both corporate structured securities carry ratings. So to the firms that are issuing those securities and seeking ratings, they feel it's important, I assume.
I see. I don't have any further questions. I'll yield back to my colleagues. I appreciate the courtesy of allowing me to ask a couple questions here by phone. And Mr. Cantor, I appreciate your time.
Sure. Welcome.
I just have one other question, and that's just on the monolines.
Mm-hmm.
Between 2002 and
and 2008. Were you involved with the ratings of the monolines, NBIA and AMBAC?
During the the midst of the crisis, and I began to become more involved in my role in credit policy. I was involved in the ratings, surveillance and ratings process for the guarantee industry, as well as almost every financial sector and sovereign sector and elements of structure. So yes,
could you give us your view on the monolines? On their ratings?
On their ratings. Well, while the monolines, and if we use the word, there are a lot of terms for bond insurance, monolines, and financial guarantors. The word monoline makes it sound like they do only one thing, and they do mostly one thing, which is to insure bonds, but they actually operate in many markets. So in one sense, they're one of the most we're perceived as a highly diversified institution. As superficial, you just saw a pie chart of what they were involved in over the years as an industry. They're involved in many things. Part of their activities that have caused them the greatest difficulties have been mortgage-related securities. And like many institutions, did not anticipate the losses would in the mortgage market would reach so far up the chain as to reach the positions that they were in. And our ratings of the bond insurers who had those exposures similarly did not anticipate the losses would reach up as high. As they turned out to do. So they were caught up in this mortgage market collapse, and their ratings have been lowered very significantly to reflect their weakened financial condition as a result of the losses they have or will experience in their mortgage-related exposures.
One final question on that. Can you comment on their leverage?
On their leverage today, or just a general view about the business model?
No, on the leverage of both NBIA and AMBAC.
I don't have a specific knowledge of their leverage today.
No, back then during the...
Oh. Well...
2007, 8.
Yeah. Leverage can be calculated in multiple ways, and the industry has operated at a very high multiple of total exposure to capital, and can be defined in many ways for capital, but whatever, the number is a large number, similar in some respects to other insurance industries when you measure their total insurance exposure to their capital base. Property casualty industry, I think, might be where people are insuring against catastrophic risk, may have much higher numbers. But the simple leverage measure of total exposure to capital is large and is typically large in an industry where you think the risks of individual losses is very low, and you think the likelihood of having a lot of defaults at once is very low. So they operated very high leverage. The view was that leverage is consistent with financial strength because the risks were very small and diversified or not likely to impact them at the same time, which for the same reasons we've discussed proved that they had greater vulnerability in the mortgage related area than anticipated going into the crisis.
Well, that's all the questions I have.
Okay.
Jason, no more. All right. What I'd like you to do just before we close out is if you should remember anything on a line of questioning that we asked you, if you remember anything differently, if you remember anything additional, if you could get a response to us through counsel, that would be great. I'd also remind you of our request for confidentiality about topics discussed, questions, lines of questioning. And that's it. I have the time as 5 minutes to 4 p.m., and I'll go off record now.